Our last scheduled speaker is Bob Whitaker. Bob is the author of a truly historic contribution to the field of exposing psychiatry, the book Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and the Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill. Bob has won many awards as a journalist covering medicine and science, including the George Polk Award for Medical Writing and a National Association for Science Writers Award for Best Magazine Article. In 1998, he co-wrote a series on psychiatric research for the Boston Globe, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. He also worked as director of publications at Harvard Medical School. His newest book is The Map Maker's Wife, A True Tale of Love, Murder, and Survival in the Amazon. Bob also lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bob Whitaker.
Well, first of all, thank you all for having me here. It's always a pleasure and an honor. One of the things I really liked about this conference is that it's really a conference where you're going to decide what sort of actions you're going to take. So it's not a conference where we're just going to talk, but really this is your conference, and the question is, what decisions will you make over this weekend? And thinking about that, I really just want to use these few minutes to raise a few questions for you, maybe to consider over these next couple of days. And they're questions that arose in the course of the past week alone, and I think it caused me to realize just the incredible extent in which psychiatry, the medical model, this whole story now infects our society. First, I had lunch with Diana Hoover, who's here today. Diana works with an international group, Medical Disability Advocacy Center, in Eastern Europe, fighting basically using legal, and if I'm wrong here, let me know, but basically legal challenges to the care or the abuse of patients there. Anyway, one of the things she talked about is how they use cage beds there. They're still in practice. And then as we were talking about this, she mentioned two things. Now, the minute I hear cage beds, and I think most people hear cage beds, you can't imagine defending cage beds. But she mentioned that there was, a doctor? Psychiatrist who was pro-cage bed, which I guess shows you that people can adopt all sorts of odd thoughts. But just hold that for a second, because one of the things maybe we're going to think about is how different Eastern Europe is than we are today. And the second thing she talked about is how there are people who are called defectologists there, and basically they go around and determining who is defective, correct? So that sounds particularly egregious, grotesque, but I want to ask you, do we have defectologists here in the United States? We do. In fact, how many defects are in the DSM? 374, something like that? All right, so we do have our defectologists, and they are drawing an ever bigger line, an ever bigger boundary line. Supposedly, I think they now say it's 20% or something like that. So the thing that, first of all, here, there is an international track. But as you go to the international track, I would raise this question. When you see pictures, and I didn't get a chance to see Laurie Ahern's movie, are there cage beds in Paraguay too? Cages, that sort of thing. We can all viscerally react to that. We know that's wrong. You don't put people in cages. But as you consider that at the international track, just raise the question, are there any similarities to what's going on here? Can you see any sort of similarities? And so is there some common cause as well? Anyway, I think we can all agree that any activist group that could in any way do what these two groups are doing, raising awareness in the United States and then working for change abroad so that people labeled mentally ill in these countries are not put in cages, we can all agree that's a very important thing. And what I'm getting to here is how important I think about the work that you're going to be taking on is. And if I had any one regret is, you'd like to see this auditorium filled with 500, 1,000 people more, because it is so profound, the challenge of what you're taking on. Now, So I had that lunch, I think it was on Tuesday, gets me thinking. Actually, this other article that appeared in the news may have appeared on Monday, I'm not sure, in the Boston Globe. And it was an article by a psychiatrist. And one of the things that's odd about newspapers is sometimes they just open up their news columns to psychiatrists. In other words, they don't have reporters do the stories. Next thing you know, you just see this article as if it's a news article. And it was extolling the virtues of Ritalin. And what the article said was that any concern about Ritalin was way overblown, and that we had studies showing how incredibly effective Ritalin was. And if there was one concern about Ritalin, it was, you know, it may dampen the appetite a bit, which may lead to a bit of suppression of growth. But the message was, in a news article, not an op-ed, was how basically wonderfully effective Ritalin was for kids, and that any concern was very minor. Now, we have a media track here. Now, here's my problem with this story. A, I don't understand why newspapers open up their news holes to psychiatrists. And they also, you'll see them open up op-ed all the time to psychiatrists. Whenever the antidepressants come under attack, you can almost be sure the New York Times will have an op-ed saying how it's all overblown. Well, first of all, why don't we have heart doctors saying how wonderful their heart drugs are? It's interesting in psychiatry that we see this. But here's my concern about this, about the media, and one thing maybe to address in the media track. What do we really know about Ritalin? What would be a complete article so people might make informed choices about parents? Well, we know Ritalin is an amphetamine. That's number one. We do know that when you take amphetamines over the long term, you expose people to the risk of psychosis. It's very well known. There's even something known as amphetamine-induced psychosis. We know that when researchers at Brookhaven Lab looked at how Ritalin worked, methylphenidate, they said it worked almost exactly like cocaine and with the same potency. Now, this was just, and basically what they found was this, that the way cocaine works, the way it raises dopamine levels in the brain is dopamine gets released into the synaptic connections, and then there's another molecule, I think it's called a transporter, that basically takes that dopamine and is involved in reuptaking it, bringing it back into the neuron. And what they found is methylphenidate does it just as well as cocaine. In other words, what cocaine does is it blocks that transporter molecule, and that's why the dopamine doesn't get reuptaked, and that's why you have more dopamine left in the synaptic cleft. And what they found was that methylphenidate, which is Ritalin, does the exact same thing as cocaine and with the same potency. So all I'm saying is if you're going to have an article about Ritalin and about how you need to give this to kids, and if I'm a parent reading this, A, I might be interested in knowing that constant use of amphetamines does carry the risk of psychosis, and I might want to know this biology of the drug. That's part of the information. Another thing I might want to know is, yes, researchers have found with Ritalin, for example, there can be some short-term behavior change that other people, that many people deem beneficial. Maybe kids pay better attention in class. But what did researchers find when they looked at long-term use of Ritalin in kids? They looked at improvement in different domains of child functioning. And guess what they found? They couldn't find a single domain where children on Ritalin improved over the long term compared to the same group of people not treated with Ritalin. So in other words, if you want to give the information to parents, is there any domain long term, and we keep kids on Ritalin long term, that you can find improvement? The answer is no. That's what the research literature shows. So that might be something that parents want to know as well. What else might they want to know? Well, if you ask kids if they like being on Ritalin, a lot of them don't. They say it makes them feel drugged out, feels them sort of numbed, et cetera, et cetera. So if you ask the kids that are placed on it, many of them don't want to be on it. You think that might be interesting. If you ask parents, how do their kids behave? Well, a high percentage of them will talk about how, well, you know, my kid after time seems sort of like a zombie, sluggish, not their usual self. That might be information you want to know about. Now, I don't know exactly the risk of psychosis with Ritalin over time, but it is a considerable risk. In other words, if you keep a kid on Ritalin 2, 3, 4 years, there's a certain percentage that will have a psychotic break. And we know what happens if you get a psychotic break. You get diagnosed with something else, bipolar, whatever it might be, get placed on an antipsychotic. So my point of this is I'm not trying to rage against Ritalin. My point is we have a media track here. And here on Monday, I read a story extolling the wonders of Ritalin, but the information was so incomplete. And it was from a doctor who obviously has, you know, a reason to sort of extol the virtues of what he uses. So one of the things that I find so problematic is, and that maybe you need to think about, is how do you get a more balanced picture of these form of treatments that we have out to the public? Because if you don't have the balanced picture, well, then people are going to make decisions, very different decisions. I mean, you can see if a doctor tells you that these are extraordinarily helpful drugs, Ritalin, for kids with ADHD, whatever that might be, and you don't hear this other part of the story, well, then you may make an uninformed decision. So we all talk about informed consent. So one of the things you might think about, what I think is so important, is how does a more complete story be told about the drugs, et cetera? So I had that. And then the very next day, Vince sent around to his group an article that appeared in the Columbus Dispatch. And this article, in some ways, reflected what happens when you don't tell the truth about the drugs. And what it was a look about the medicating of kids in Ohio on Medicaid. So these are poor kids. So what is our society doing to poor kids today? And Dominic mentioned this. He used some very strong words about genocide, sort of attacking their humanity. I just want to list, first of all, by age, what they found, the number of kids, poor kids, on these different psychiatric drugs. Now, this first age group is 0 to 3. So we're talking about infants, babies. Anti-anxiety drugs. They had 575 kids on anti-anxiety drugs. First of all, I'm not even sure how a one-year-old expresses that they're anxious about life, but apparently they do. Now, this next one, and think about this weekend. And think about now, we're going to tie this for a second back to those caged beds. How many 0 to 3-year-olds are on antipsychotics? Haldol, risperidone. Any guess? Now, this is just poor kids in Ohio. Anybody guess how many kids they found being prescribed Haldol, risperidone?
737.
Well, thank God it's not 737. But it's 109 they found. Antipsychotic drugs, babies. Now, how can you put a baby on an antipsychotic? Now, we all know, Dominic talked about it. An antipsychotic drug, it limits your movement. It limits your ability to be curious about the world. It limits your ability to be emotionally engaged with that world. We also know a couple things. When you're 0 to 3, your brain is basically forming itself in reaction to the world. I mean, you're born with this incredibly flexible brain. You put a kid on an antipsychotic, and not only do you dampen all these sort of chance to be human, but the brain will change in response to that antipsychotic. And we even have things where we know that you have things like with internal movement. I mean, some people experience akathisia. I'm not sure how a baby expresses that they're feeling akathisia. So my question to you is this. Is that a caged bed? For that baby born and is a year old and is put on an antipsychotic, what is the difference between that and a caged bed? Because that baby's brain will not develop normally. And they're not having the chance to learn to engage the world in any sort of natural way. And I'd ask us, what sort of society permits putting babies on antipsychotic drugs? And this is just poor children in Ohio. It's going on in every state in the country. I've seen, and this is where I was tying it into this conversation. Diana was talking about doctors who said they were pro-cage bed. Well, there were doctors in this Columbus article who were pro-putting kids on antipsychotics. It was called access to therapy, access to treatment. So one of the things that is so difficult here, and this goes to the Ritalin thing, is you have the story out about how benign these drugs are and how helpful they are. And unfortunately, that's not beginning to be the whole story. But yet when you see it in newspapers, it starts becoming common wisdom. And next thing you know, you have people thinking that you can give antipsychotics to 1 year old children and it's not going to harm them. And you can see how one thing leads to another. But you lead to a society that is creating, is doing something that, in my opinion, is I don't know any other word for it, but evil. If you put a one-year-old baby on an antipsychotic, that is an evil thing to do. And I just wonder, how do we respond to that? We know not to do cage beds, but what do we do with a baby? So just think about that. How many 4 to 5 year olds on antipsychotics? 545. Oh, by the way, I missed one thing. One of the things that people are now saying is they can diagnose maybe schizophrenia in a 1 year old. Again, I'm not sure how they express their psychosis. By the way, every one of my child was psychotic when they were one because they all had these imaginary worlds. My older daughter had two mice that lived on the toilet. They even had names, etc. But we avoided the antipsychotics at that time. Anyway, 545 4 to 5 year olds. I'm just trying to give the extent of this. One state, poor kids only. There's more kids on it. 6 to 12 year olds. How many 6 to 12 year olds, poor kids in Ohio, on antipsychotics? Any guess?
1,000.
1,000. You think we're putting 1,000 kids on antipsychotics? That'd be horrific. 5,757, 6 to 12 years old. Now, just one quick thing. I've seen a study on olanzapine. What happens to the brain on olanzapine after, I don't know, 3 years or something? Well, they talked about how it starts shrinking. The cerebral cortex starts shrinking. Not a great thing to do. Olanzapine, I'm sure olanzapine's one they're using. We know there's a problem with diabetes, metabolic dysfunction. You're going to induce that in an 8-year-old? And we know what's happening. These kids are getting it because they're misbehaving they're considered misbehaving. In Massachusetts, by the way, I think the number is of foster kids now on drugs, it's something like 70%. So you're poor in Massachusetts. You're born to a family that's dysfunctional, basically, because that's how you get in foster care. And somehow you're the problem. You're the problem. You're the kid who deserves the label. I don't know what the label they get. It's, what's the word if they just don't behave well? I don't know. They're so what? What is it?
Conduct disorder.
Okay, 13 to 18 kids on antipsychotics. How many do you think? Well, 6,249. So in Ohio, they have 12,660 kids on antipsychotics. And in my opinion, my guess is virtually every one of those kids is being harmed by that form of care. That is an incredible degree of harm. And so it's just something to think about how all this is playing out. And for me, it did start with this image of cage beds because it's so visceral. We know it's wrong to put a kid in a cage bed. But those of you who've experienced neuroleptics, especially against your will, often know it can be a very painful, confining sort of thing. And you can be almost sure that these kids are not volunteering to be on Haldol or whatever it might be. By the way, the total number of kids 18 years and under who were on psychiatric drugs was 40,000 kids in Ohio. Then the last question, just how difficult. So I guess the reason I went through these numbers is try to send a sense of the extent of this problem, because it fits in with what Paul is talking to. Paul has, they say you're crazy. Well, yes, we've expanded this boundary that is so incredible as to who we're saying is crazy. And now we're expanding it to children. And as we do that, one of the questions we need to ask is, are we causing some incredible amount of harm, especially to the kids? And final thing is, and I think this is where you get how this whole battle is so confusing and how it's so difficult to sort things out and it's difficult to come up with an agenda that makes sense. is on Friday there was an ad in the last, I think it was probably on the op-ed page of the Boston Globe, and it was an ad saying, don't cut funding for mental health. We need access to treatment. Now, access to treatment makes sense in a certain way, especially if you're talking about access to shelter, if you're talking about access to food, access to things you need. That makes perfect sense. There can be people in extreme distress that need help, no question about that. But access is, as we've seen, is such a two-edged sword. Because access also means access to forced treatment, so to speak. So I guess what I'm trying to leave you with here tonight is the sense that it's great you're all here. You're taking on an issue and a group of issues that on the one hand I think is so profound for our society. I think you're really talking about issues about how we are defining ourselves today, how we define humanity, how we define childhood, how we define the spectrum of, let's see if I can get this right. One of the things, it becomes a philosophy we're talking about as well, because if we go back far enough, and I would think like when I was growing up in college, one of the nice things is, well, you have the sense that you should celebrate the spectrum of people. You should celebrate and enjoy differences. People who are idiosyncratic. People who are obsessive, oh, they could be very interesting. People who were, and I know we're not supposed to use this word, but let me use it in this word. People who were a little crazy could be a lot of fun. The point is that there was a philosophy that might be, and, you know, I grew up at a time when we talked about existentialism. You had to suffer. To suffer was to be alive. You should embrace suffering. So my point is, the philosophy that we are being given today is a philosophy of being. And it's a philosophy of being that if you step outside these boundaries, whatever they might be, that somehow that makes you abnormal, means you have to be changed. Even that is a very dangerous thing if someone doesn't want to be changed. And so what you're all addressing here this weekend is, in my mind, so profound to what sort of society we're going to be, what sort of society we're going to have for our children, and also to look in the mirror in essence and say, especially with the children, have we reached a point where we are doing incredible harm? And think about babies on antipsychotics, because to my mind, that's just as visceral as kids in cage beds. Because I honestly cannot imagine any rationale, any possible good rationale for giving Haldol to, say, a six-month-old baby. I just don't know that rationale. Anyway, thanks and have a great couple days.